we're getting beyond government and governance, and we're talking about what are the values that drive our behavior, and how are those values shaped, and how do we shape those together? And so a community of practice is a place to really work on that and confront the fact that it is often values, not regulations, that are at the heart of how we're making decisions.
Welcome to WorkWise, the growth mindset for wisdom at work. I'm Ken Kennard of Accent Interactive, and my co-host is Mike Boys of Credo Consulting. We're speaking today with Scott Francisco. He's the founder and director of Pilot Projects, a design and consulting firm founded on the belief that small things, well designed and fully realized, can catalyze big systemic changes. So Mike, just a follow-up from our last episode, we talked a lot about millennials in the workplace and the other generations that are receiving them into the workplace and how that's going. And I'm curious what kind of feedback you've gotten about this topic from people that have listened to this podcast and are asking you questions about this.
Yeah. Well, I've had lots of conversations, and it's an easy conversation to get in because there's a war going on.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a war. It's a war of words. And the war of words is really about the boomers feeling disrespected because what they have to offer comes from their values. And the millennials are saying, I don't want your values.
What values are they?
Well, I think it's values that respect the social order of things. It's the values that say that that communication is important, that how you present yourself is important, that putting in your time to learn the basics is essential before you can go anywhere.
Now, millennials don't want that. They want a fast track to success, right?
They want a fast track to success. And the millennials are, the boomers are saying, well, I had to wait 20 years for that. So get in line, pal, which is kind of crazy and unrealistic. So maybe there's somewhere to meet in between. But it's the get in line mentality. You ain't overstepping me, all right? Stay in line. I'm going to keep you down.
And these are the same boomers that the millennials are coming to and saying, hey, mentor me, show me things. How's that working for them?
I don't think it's working so well. I don't think it's not working. It's not working at all. I think that it's a shift in values and mentalities. And until I think really the boomers act mature and realize I have something to give, and I am going to understand that I'm the giver, I am the teacher here, and tolerate somewhat what they view as the nonsense, then they can teach lessons that will be heard. But if when they get offended and get an uproar about it, they're not helping either side. So boomers really need to be mature in their perspective about things.
Well, speaking of mature, I have to make an observation about you. Recently, after we did the last episode of the podcast, both you and I showed up at the same event. This was an art show that our children were in as students. Remember this event?
Yep. It was fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. And what I noticed...
Our kids are amazing. Yeah. Can I tell you that? They're amazing. And I'm really afraid for when they hit the workforce.
Oh.
Because I'm not ready for them. Like, I'll be out of a job.
Yeah, right. That's a big threat, right? Talk about a war. So one of the observations I made is that your life would be very different, actually, with just a few small changes in how your life turned out. You talked about in the last episode that you're kind of halfway between a boomer and an Xer.
I'm straddling.
Yeah. Well, you were born in 1964. What if, instead of marrying the woman that you did, what if you married a woman that was born in 1960? Clearly a boomer.
Clearly an older lady.
Yes. A foxy older lady. Okay. And what if...
And that's what we would call her, foxy.
Right. Because, it was the early...
It was the thing.
It was the thing. There you go. And instead of getting married later, you got married when you were like 21, 22.
So not at 36, but like...
Right. So now 22. it's like, mid 80s, you're getting married. So you've got this foxy lady. You're probably going to start having kids now. The kids are born in like late 80s, early 90s. By today, they would be like 22 to 30 years old. They're out of college already, right?
Oh my.
So your peer group, your parenting peer group would have been consisting of mostly boomers, And your approach to parenting would be shaped by that group. Therefore, not only would you be raising millennials with the millennial values in that culture, but you'd be raising them as a boomer. Contrast that to today, where you married later. You married a woman who was born in the early 70s.
Right.
You didn't have children until after 9/11, which puts you clearly in the camp of a parenting group that is Generation X. And so instead of being the youngest parent at the art show, you're now the oldest parent at the art show.
I'm always the oldest parent at the art show.
So,
but I look good.
You're very well dressed, I have to say.
I'm talking about wrinkles.
Oh, wrinkles.
And gray hair.
Oh, well, that too. My goodness. So it just occurs to me that that group has probably not only shaped your parenting and your approach and how you deal with the next generation, but it's also maybe even changes how you approach work and that sort of thing. So what do you see there? I'm curious about that.
Well, I think it make a great point that a person is shaped not only by when they're born, but when they have different life experiences. And certainly I'm surrounded by, I mean, just them going to an art show that our kids are featured in with other parents, that wasn't happening back in the late 80s. Like, those things were not going on. And I think in the workplace, it shapes it because I am kind of, I'm a tweener, really. I look at the pure boomers and I think, oh man, they got to come up to date. They got to change their perspective because it's really kind of outdated, and probably in some ways their treatment of people, forgetting them and engaging them, was never a great mentality. And I think, oh, they really need to learn some. And I'm an Xer, I'm a boomer Xer mix. And I'm looking at these two things and I'm saying I'm neither of them. So I got both legs. I got one leg on both sides of the fence. And so I always feel kind of like actually that I'm the outsider looking in at their perspectives.
Yeah. But that gives you such a unique position when it comes to the millennials, because you can see both generations' perspectives ahead of them. And that gives you a great place from which you can consult and coach and mentor people on really being successful in the workplace. And one of the people that I know that's been very successful working with millennials is someone I want to bring into the conversation for this podcast. Scott Francisco is not only a teacher, a professor of millennials now, in the School of Architecture at Kane University. But he also employs them, trains them, mentors them, brings them up in the craft of architecture and urban planning and solving some of the unique challenges that really resonate with the millennial generation, such as, climate change and sustainability
maybe,
Right. And creating a place where this earth is better off and we're really taking good care of it. And a couple of episodes ago, we were talking with Chip Roper about collaboration. And one of the ways to collaborate is to form a community of practice, this group of people that share a common interest and vision and some of the same disciplines working together. I know that Scott is an expert in that, and he has some recent experience pulling together a community of practice. So I'm anxious to hear what he has to say about that. So I'm really excited to bring you into the conversation, Scott, because I'm familiar with some of the work that you've been doing with pilot projects, and even more recently with this new community of practice that's been started around this work. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that community. How did this community of practice get started?
It all really started with a project that I initiated about 8 years ago called the Brooklyn Bridge Forest. Which is a project that immediately demanded collaboration from a huge variety of people. The project is a concept to link a forest community supplying sustainably sourced wood with the Brooklyn Bridge and the need for wood for the boardwalk, and figuring out a way to connect globally the need from New York City with a forest community doing sustainable forestry. Some of the areas I knew very little about, so it was collaboration from day one. And that project, which we may talk about later, but it led to building relationships and bridges with forest ecologists, with people in the sustainable timber industry, with communities that are living in tropical forests, and just a huge breadth of relationships. And through that, I started meeting a lot of folks in the forestry and environmental sciences area, and kind of getting into a different door of academia. My background is architecture and sort of quite familiar with the academy and from the architectural side, but I didn't know very much about it on the ecology and forestry side. And years into the project, and many collaborations having been developed, lots of folks were talking about this need more broadly for getting groups of people together from different sectors, from different discipline areas, different expertise areas, to work on problems together. And that's what we had been doing in an ad hoc way with the Brooklyn Bridge Forest. And this idea of a community of practice was out there, but it hadn't been widely practiced. And there was enough people excited about it that a group formed from the University of Michigan. There was a forest research group there. They actually had a conference in Paris aligned with the COP21 summit there on climate change. And from that conference that they organized, there was a groundswell to create a community of practice. I got drawn into writing co-authoring a paper with four other academics on the topic of how do you start a community of practice, what is it? And my contribution was systems thinking and how a community of practice, like any other subculture, is a system that involves both kind of the harder edge things like policies and spaces and so forth, but also the cultural side of symbols and identity and values and what's driving people to participate in this community. So we're still co-authoring this. The publication is several months out still. And at the same time, there was another offshoot of the Brooklyn Bridge Forest. While we were trying to get New York City excited about using sustainably sourced wood on one of their most iconic pieces of infrastructure, many people came out of the woodwork and were interested in looking at that question more broadly. How does the city procure materials for rebuilding its infrastructure generally? And could there be a bigger dialogue on wood, which is now really understood to be by far the most sustainable building material in terms of its carbon footprint, in terms of its ecological impacts? Could we talk about that with ecologists in the room, with forest conservationists in the room, with architects and engineers and industry people all in the same room? So we actually started that process, reached out to hundreds of people, and got a core group together to talk about it.
So Scott, there are some things in there that really strike me as being really important for this. And I think one of them is, and maybe the least interesting, I think, maybe, you know, in terms of interest level, I think it's great interest, is that really this came out on top of a social movement that was there anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That people would have had a growing desire to conserve and preserve and to make things sustainable. And so this effort, it was, you know, really birthed out of that increased desire that people had, and they came out of the woodwork, right?
Yeah.
That's a fascinating thing. But you said something else that I think is really interesting, and that is that people saw that they were dependent upon each other. They had a small area of expertise, and they wanted to do something big, and realized, I can't do this alone. And so they had to reach out to the community.
Yes. For example, some of the most enthusiastic participants were architects. And I think the architectural community, who tends to love wood in general, you know, it's a beautiful material, and we love to build with it. But frankly, we just don't know very much about where it comes from in terms of the real impacts. You know, when you cut a tree down, in some ways it's a traumatic thing. You're cutting this beautiful organism down, and you know, it's in a forest, and what's happening? And they really desperately kind of wanted to know, how can we do that really deeply? How can we do this in a way that is sustainable?
Right. I understand that pain because I'm a gardener, and you know, there comes a time with plants when you have to either pull them or split them, and sometimes when you split them, you don't have anybody to give them to, and I feel like I'm taking a life.
Yeah, exactly. But the, you know, what was interesting is that the on the forest conservation side, there was also this movement of conservation through community management, and really that means a consumption of the forest products in a sustainable way. So if you go back in time, conservation tended to mean strict protection. You put a boundary around it and you don't touch it. But that's become increasingly really unrealistic in many parts of the world, and actually not very effective, actually, in even when it's being done. But what has been effective, and this has surprised a lot of people in the conservation area, that communities that have been given ownership and rights to use the forest wisely, with some level of guidance and guidelines, can do a much better job of conserving it for biodiversity, plants and animals, and for their own needs. And that synergy is incredibly powerful. So imagine the power of linking that up, that synergy up with cities which are leaders in the world on consumption, and saying, look, we're only going to procure wood from community sources that are doing it right.
Yeah. So it strikes me, Scott, that there's an upswell of interest and a desire on these people's part to join together for increased learning and for sharing ideas and so on. But at some point, there was a decision made to answer that call by doing some kind of facilitation to bring these people together in some way. And so before we go into detail of the story of that, I'm just wondering about your mindset, about the mindset that you had at that point when you saw that there was an opportunity, a need, and there was a potential solution out there. How did you approach that?
A lot of things are racing through my mind when you ask that question, because it's like a lot of systems thinking sort of responses. It's sort of everything at once, kind of. And systems thinking encourages us not to go through things in a linear fashion, but there's sort of, so it's like, yeah, it's all of these things together. It's about bringing people together into a common space, an actual room around a real table, so that people can hear each other in real time, that conversations are fluid, that people can see each other's interacting and reacting. So my experience as a designer and a convener has just proven time and time again that physical presence together is incredibly powerful. So right off the bat, you know, as this concept for a community of practice around the use of wood sustainably sourced for city infrastructure was fermenting, it was, I want to get the people together for a day to start with, and just see if there's a kind of chemistry there for these people to work together on this topic in the future.
I'm curious about what's going on mentally as you do that, because it seems to me that this is a new thing, that it might fail, that it's even though it's got a lot of potential, you don't know exactly where it's going, and you're bringing people. Academics are not known for, they don't have a reputation for like working well together and getting a lot done quickly. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So it seems to me there's certain challenges. So I'm curious about your mental process.
That's, you know, you actually hit on a really, really great point there. The challenge itself is one of the, is sort of one of the facilitators of this. You want to try to do something that hasn't been done before. And the fact that academics are often known to be somewhat isolating, publications often demand authorship styles that tend to be individualistic and tend to be siloing. So there was a challenge. The challenge was, is it possible to get this diversity of voices into one space? Will they even come? Will they play well together? Will they be interested in each other? So it was a challenge. I love challenges. So if it wasn't a challenge, it probably never would have happened, to be perfectly honest. Another is the excitement of hearing new conversations emerge. So I guess with the challenge is once the once results start coming in and the results are positive, it's a great energizer. So there was a desire among, and I was by no means the only person organizing this. There was a core group of about five of us who represented to some degree the different disciplines and fields. So we were all reaching out to our networks. We were, you know, from around the world, folks in government, folks in academia, in the architecture and design community, and saying to them, would you be interested in participating in something like this?
Yeah. So Scott, something you emphasized earlier was that you said getting around a real table, not a cyber table or a metaphysical table, but a real table. And I'm wondering what makes you stress that? Like, what's the deal with being in a real room together?
Well, I'm not sure if I should go here yet, but hopefully at some point we can talk about this problem-solving design process we call the sandbox. But it's something I've been working on for about the last 12 years as a way to bring people together to solve design challenges. It started in the workplace domain, which is, you know, basically creating workplace environments for organizations. And it really stressed two or three critical ideas. One is visible constraints of the problem, and the other was physical participation in the problem solving. And it was a physical gaming environment where there was pieces and parts that could be moved around in a kind of game board type setup. And what I saw over time in experimenting with this, and we continue to use it and experiment, it's a process that'll never be finished, but every time we have a client that uses it, we learn something new. But the key thing is that when people are together solving a problem in physical space, looking at each other, talking to each other, negotiating in real time, and others can hear that conversation. So you can have 10 people around a table, or even sometimes up to 20, and you get numerous conversations going. The speed at which people can solve problems is increased dramatically.
Right.
And the empathy for other points of view is present. Whereas if you're going through email or other portals, it's easy to be dismissive. It's easy to only see what you want to see. You can, you know, writing an email response to someone can very often fly off into a tangent, which doesn't capture the nuance of what the person was really trying to say.
Right.
But when that person is there in front of you, and they're moving that enclosed office into a space that you feel is your space, or you want that space for, you know, an open collaboration zone, and you're saying, do we really need another office? That conversation is going to happen.
And yeah.
So I learned from that experience and continue to learn that people present, looking at each other, listening to each other, these are all skills that have to be cultivated. They're not a given that people do listen, but we're actually learning on the fly.
And that's something that's really interesting to me is that, you know, my work is organization development, leadership development work, working in organizations to help them solve problems and build healthy places, not physically, but, you know, climate-wise and culture-wise. And, you know, so getting these people together physically in a room is often very important, but you've added a different thing here, which is making the problem physical, where they have to actually solve a concrete problem right before them, where they have to manipulate things. And that has a way of focusing people on the reality of things. And it sounds like you've really mastered that.
Well, that's the beauty of the sandbox tool, I think, is that it solves a space problem in the space dimension. It solves a collaborative problem collaboratively. It solves a relational problem relationally, right? That if we're all stakeholders in this thing and we're all going to have some kind of, it's going to impact our work and our ability to perform, then can't we also have a little bit of a role in the process of building it and shaping it so that our values are expressed in the solution? And so here's this sandbox tool that's being leveraged for the benefit of the client. And here, Scott, I hear what you're doing is taking that same learning, that same kind of tool, that same approach, and now applying it to this other sphere, this community of practice. And I'm wondering how they received that, or how effective was it in that domain, some of those same principles, if not the actual sandbox tool itself.
One thing that the Wood at Work convening shared with the sandbox was a shared outcome. So this wasn't the Wood at Work kind of conference, which is really the birthing of a community of practice, we hoped, because we couldn't say from the outset whether that would be entirely successful. But It has been so far, but we wanted within that time and space to get a kind of consensus of some sort on the part of the community if it was possible. That was that's a pretty big ask for a bunch of people who are coming together who don't know each other for the first time, and see if we could come up with, as a group, a resolution to recommend to New York City in the way New York City procures wood. So we had this goal that we would get 100 and some people together, again, from all these different backgrounds, to agree on something. And
in one day.
In one day, right?
And hey, my first question is, are you insane? And and if you were successful, is there an S on your chest? Right? Like I want to hear more about this.
Yeah. Good gracious.
It was pretty incredible. And you know, there were a number of people who said exactly that. Don't even bother. It's not going to happen. It'll be a disaster. But the process of hearing people from these different points of view, and I think the diversity of points of view really helped out. It softened people. There's a certain kind of openness, I think, when people were speaking from points of view that were different enough that each of our own kind of core expertise area were not enough to sort of just bring a critical mindset. Only a critical mindset, which we're so used to doing, especially in academia. We're very good at being critical and being critical of our peers who are, you know, bringing slightly different, you know, twists on a similar theme. But when you're hearing someone speak from, you know, tropical rainforest community development perspective, and you're an engineer who, you know, is working on fire protection for wood structures, you open up in a different way. So you had 100 people who had sat through almost a whole day of these different presentations, and there was breakout sessions. There was a Japanese saw master. And so we all got our hands on wood, and we were able to actually learn how to use a Japanese saw.
That sounds cool.
It was really cool. So at the end of the day, we said, we want to try this. We realize this is ambitious. We want to try to create a resolution that captures some of the essence of what we did here today for New York City. And we created a resolution, and we had an actual wooden board that we had everyone who was present sign to capture this idea that New York City is a world leader and its consumption habits do impact the consumption habits of the world, that forests are threatened, that community forest conservation and management was one of the key solutions, and that if New York City could consume in a way that favored sustainable consumption and sustainable management of forests, we could have an enormous impact on rainforest conservation in particular, let alone forest conservation in general. So that resolution exists now as a piece of the Wood at Work community. We're already beginning to plan our next annual event, and we've had several breakoff activities and small get-togethers in the meantime.
So Scott, I'm wondering about the recipe for success here. It's obvious you were successful in pulling off something very difficult. It sounds like the key factors were the diversity of the audience, that you said that softened people to each other and give them a little more of an open mindset, less critical. It seems to me though that that's necessary but not sufficient. What else would you point to as getting the people from their siloed mentalities and their different world perspectives to be on the same page in such a short time to reach this kind of resolution?
There's a playfulness to this that I think was important, that this wasn't just people sitting around in chairs all day. We had really put a lot of effort in the choreographing the day. So getting people up, talking to each other, things like the Japanese sawing station. I mean, it's amazing how many barriers can be broken down by people standing beside each other and listening to being coached on how to use a saw. And it's a little bit of the sort of water cooler idea. When you move out of one sort of space into another, you often open up and the conversation becomes more social. So there was a social dimension here that was real. People wanted to get to know each other and so forth. So that's another way of breaking down borders and critique. And I think the common a common vision that was present in the selection of even who was coming. So, I mean, there is also a sort of curation of who's in the room, and diversity is critical, but it's also critical to have good leaders, people that see themselves as change makers in their industries, who know that there is a problem, and really want to be part of a solution. So I think everyone who was in the room came wanting to be part of a solution. They might not have known what the solution was, and not to say we know exactly what the solution is now, but we have a certain basis of agreement now that we can, from our different fields, contribute to a solution.
And that kind of answers one of the questions that was kind of burning in my head was, how'd you get these folks there? And it sounds like your answer is, we found people who were interested in change and who saw themselves as people who could affect change. And by virtue of that, they'd want to come. Is that a fair?
It is. It is. And, you know, we're authoring this paper right now on building a community of practice. And the paper happened actually mostly after the Wood at Work group. So we were able to learn from that. And we're sort of putting these sort of constituent elements together of what will make a successful start to a community of practice and what will help sustain it. So how do we get those people into the room? That was a bit of a coup in itself because, you know, people are so busy to dedicate a whole day to something like this. I'm wondering how we did it now that I'm thinking about it.
Do you see why I called you insane?
Yeah. How do we do it? I mean, actually, it's really building on the relationships of the participants. So, you know, the co-organizers of the event all have their own networks. There's a few people that we are, close enough to that we can pretty much say, you need to be at this event, right? But there might only be two or three people that we have that level of pull with. But each of those people have a network of people that look up to them and that they look up to. So there's sort of two directions of mentorship that are occurring here. There's people that I was asking up to. So one of my mentors is Kenneth Frampton, who's maybe the greatest living architectural historian, certainly of modern architecture. He's a professor at Columbia. He's authored dozens of books, and he's really seen as one of the greats. And he had agreed to be there. And so he's one example of a number of really key people whose presence there pulled in participation, raised the level of expectation, quality of the outcome, why this is going to be important. So in each of the fields, there was, you know, two or three really important leaders that everyone looked up to. And so that brought with it a level of seriousness, excitement to hear what these people had to say. People were on the edge of their seats. I mean, it was really amazing. And we, throughout the day and for weeks afterwards, had people that we didn't expect to respond with this level of enthusiasm say that this is one of the most wonderful, uplifting educational events they'd been to in a long, long time. And that wasn't our doing. That was the doing of all the participants who brought their best work to the table.
So, Scott, it seems to me it's easy to have a good event compared to having an actual movement afoot, compared to having an actual sustained effort. And you're talking about people who are pretty busy. You know, they've got their own day job. So I'm curious about what things have you put in place that will allow this community of practice to not only stay intact, stay in community with each other, space being one of the big parts that you emphasize there, but also getting stuff done. You know, not just agreeing in principle, but enacting some kind of change. Where are you guys with that? I know it's pretty new, but I'm just curious in the last few months how that's been going.
I suspect that it's going to be, a couple of years before this really reaches a feeling of critical mass and long-term sustainability that it might not require my individual time, but leadership is going to be critical. We're hoping that new leaders will emerge from the community. That's a proof, I think, of its sustainability that begins to have its own life. But there's also the context around the community of practice. So if you think about a community of practice as a sort of cultural system in a way, like there's the question we keep asking, why are people participating in the first place? How can that participation be maintained? One of the answers is the context. Is the context feeding the community of practice in terms of new problems that need to be responded to, and in a sense, the food for keeping this thing going? So for example, the climate change, the growing interest and demand for climate change innovation, let's just say, to mitigate climate change is a huge part of that context. So as people in their own fields are being more and more inundated with questions about what are we doing to either conserve energy, reduce our carbon outputs, think differently about the way we consume, the community of practice in this case becomes a place to come back to and say, we've got to think more creatively about this. If I'm an architect and I'm designing really cool buildings, but they're made of concrete and steel, there's a point on the horizon where every architect knows that is going to be, I mean, eventually it's going to be outlawed because the carbon intensity of those materials is so high that, you know, it's, if climate change and just the way we're treating our environment generally becomes enough of a focus, we're going to have to change our practices. And so the people want to get ahead of that game, and they want to be thinking right, creatively ahead of time.
You know, Scott, while you were talking, there's something that occurred to me, and it was in the version of your article you shared with me that it occurred to me there as well, but I think it seems really relevant here. And it seems like the community of practice is or could be a great place for people with liberal values and conservative values to mix and put their heads together that's not in an adversarial environment.
I think that is a great observation, and actually it did happen here. It was interesting because climate change, unfortunately, has been somewhat of a divisive issue. But where it connects, I think people of goodwill across the entire spectrum is treating the earth well, and things like biodiversity. It's pretty hard to argue with the fact that the species that inhabit the earth are valuable and that we should be doing more to protect right. them. And I think the idea of culture is another really interesting connector between people with a more liberal mindset and people with a more conservative mindset. I really believe personally that's a place where we're getting beyond government and governance, and we're talking about what are the values that drive our behavior. Mm-hmm. And how are those values shaped? And how do we shape those together? And so a community of practice is a place to really work on that and confront the fact that it is often values, not regulations, that are at the heart yeah. of how we're making decisions.
And I think that that you said beyond government, and I think I would phrase it differently. I would say before government, because when the community doesn't do something, the smaller community doesn't do something, the federal government feels like they have to move in, or people push them into the fray. And what you're saying is the community that touches these things is solving the problem so that we don't need legislation to force some, you know, harebrained ideas upon us.
Right. Right. And, you know, if you not to get into too much detail on the liberal conservative thing, but if the liberal side of the conversation tends towards regulation as a solution, which I think is relatively safe to say, and the conservative side tends more a little bit more towards sort of a market-based solution often, what I would like to put between those is that cultural solution, just like you've said it, and say, look, if your desire is to have less intervention on the part of the government, how do you create a culture that solves the problem first?
Right.
And let's demonstrate to each other and to the wider and wider sort of circles of culture and influence that we can do this. And we're going to, you know, the way that we consume, the way that we teach, the way that we mentor, the way that we just operate in all of our different cultural spheres can have such a huge impact. And what's interesting is that is being proven in the forest conservation domain, that community action, which is largely cultural action, has proven to be more powerful than, in many cases, than policy action. Now, I will say they often go hand in hand. That's a really important thing to recognize, that sort of culture without any kind of formal regulation is not necessarily the best way to solve big global problems. But we can see that some of the best conservation efforts have been grassroots organized, have been started and maintained at the community level, and are community and culture first. And support, if regulations are there, which they often are, they're supported and upheld by the values of the community.
Yeah, that's so important. And so you're pointing to the impact that this can have. And it occurs to me that some of our listeners might be in different communities of practice that could learn from this example. And so I'm wondering what you've learned by way of skills. What skills does it take? What skills does it draw upon for either a leader like yourself in this community practice or participants in the community that may be different from some of the skills that are involved in architecture or space planning or research into the conservation?
Well, if you don't mind, I might talk about some that are different and some that are the same, because I think that it's interesting how many of the skills are actually similar, but people might not have thought about it that way. So in other words, things like a poetic leadership, and that's a term that I use once in a while, and it's maybe a little obscure. It really talks about how people use language and even visuals and other types of sort of symbolic elements to tell the story and to draw people into a new space of understanding. So the age-old skill of rhetoric, which has kind of had a bad rap in a way over the last, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 years, it's so important for people to be compelling in the way that they tell a story and share their values, to draw others into that space. That's one. Being a great listener, that's one that I struggle with sometimes, I sort of have to continually check myself. And for a culture to be built successfully, it has to be built by the community. And leadership may come with a visionary idea or a compelling vision to share, but it never becomes cultural until it is deeply absorbed and embodied by others. And that almost only happens when it's a dialogue. So the idea that dialogue is shaping the culture, which is a system that has to be co-built. So compelling, and poetic visions that people can see and hear and touch, and they can almost, chew on them as they're walking and running and thinking and working. It's like, yeah, there's something there. I see something new. I see something that's captivating. I'm part of a conversation. People are listening to me. I'm actually contributing something. Again, I do think physical space is really important, and that would have been something we didn't even need to mention 25 years ago and past, because it would have almost been built into the way people interacted. Mm-hmm. But now there's so much going on that is virtual that sort of stepping out of that becomes increasingly unnatural for some people. And so I think being able to foreground that, like get people together, even if there is an online form of the community, getting everyone together, absolutely critical, more critical than ever today.
Yeah. I was thinking about how that relates to this generation of workers. So a lot of the people coming in to this field that are really passionate about climate change and about conservation and so on are the millennials that we've talked about in a previous episode. And they come, it seems to me, with strong values in this area. And yet some of the things that you're talking about go a little bit against some of their values. Like they're so virtual that they tend to want to stay in that virtual realm as they connect. And you're saying, no, let's meet in person. There's high value on these high bandwidth, very expensive interactions of being in the same place at the same time. And so I'm wondering, as a leader, how you're bringing along this millennial generation to achieve some of the things that they want to achieve, but maybe using systems and processes that might require some adjustment on their part?
Yeah, it's such a great question, and don't have any silver bullets for it. But I teach millennials in architecture, and one of the struggles, to put it frankly, is that there isn't this sort of what I would call socio-spatial skill set that I think was a little bit more baked into pre-millennials, where just, you know, working together in a physical space and the kind of skills of just regular conversation, working together, drawing together, et cetera, were considered normal. So I think, sorry, millennials, but that's I think opportunities for doing that are really important. And I think a community of practice can be a really great way to bring millennials into that physical environment. And I think doing things is a really important piece of a community of practice, getting things done, working together, small projects, pilot projects. That's the name I gave to my company because I so believe in the utility and power of small projects completed together that demonstrate ideas and values in a physical form, and that people have participated in that. And that's a way of building a culture. So I think for millennials who may not have had as much time in sort of that physical cooperative making and building things, some have a tremendous amount of experience, but I think across the board we would see a lower level of that. Imagine joining this sort of interesting group where when I'm part of this, I get to have conversations with people that are, you know, 10, 20, 30 years more experienced than I am, mm-hmm. in the same space.
Yeah. And you're giving me on ideas for how we onboard millennials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe the onboarding experience is giving them groups work that they have to collaborate and communicate and teach them to do that in their initial project as some 3-month thing where they learn those skills and they learn those norms for the organization. Maybe I'll have to build something like that.
I totally agree. In fact, I just walked in from a little project like that on the campus here where I'm teaching at Kane University. And the project was a straw bale passive solar conference room that the students are physically building. They worked on it over spring break, which just finished. And a lot of these students had never picked up a hammer before. And I was actually not here. So it was really interesting. It was like, here's the problem. Here are the materials. Here's a small budget. Work together. There's a group of 10 students who agreed to work on this over the break and make this happen. And, you know, it's a little rough around the edges, but it's really cool. And they have learned so much already by just getting their hands dirty and working together and trying to solve problems together. And the physical result can't be argued with. There it is. You know, is the wall straight or not straight? And having that sort of third thing to look at, I think, is extremely helpful. The other thing is, you know, in learning, you brought up the term learning, and it's so important, but there's different types of learning, of course. And one that I'm interested in very much is this relationship between craftsmanship and innovation. So innovation gets a lot of airtime lately, and many organizations see innovation as key to their success. If they don't innovate, they're going to die. I would argue that craftsmanship is equally important, and that good innovation both requires craftsmanship in many respects, but it also works well with craftsmanship. And craftsmanship is different than innovation. Its values are different. Its values are about doing something well for its own sake, and the beauty of a job well done. That in some ways kind of it works well with tradition, and innovation doesn't sort of have a lot in common with tradition. And, you know, it's important to balance these kinds of values out, I believe.
When you say craftsman, you know, I think of a craftsman, I think of a woodworker, or I think of a, you know, mostly I think of woodworkers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But is that the sense you mean it in? What are the crafts? What might be an example of a craft you're talking about?
Writing would be a great example. You know, writing is a very demanding pursuit to do it well. And in many respects, to be a good writer, it's subjecting yourself to all of the rules, all of the, you know, history and traditions of good writing. And at a certain point, innovation can come once there's a mastery of the basics, and beyond just the basics, even you know, the beauty of a well-written piece is a crafted piece. And you can see how craftsmanship then can lead to innovation. Whereas, you know, many and most of the great innovators of in the technical realm have first been great craftsmen. They've known machines, the machines, I'm using that term now generally, they've known their field very well, and they've subjected themselves to often years, decades of learning. Miles Davis, you know, a great example in music, classically trained musician, you know, years and years and years of practicing the scales. His innovations didn't just sort of pop out of thin air. They came from discipline.
Right, yeah.
But we often forget that. It's easy to focus on the kind of the sexy part of like coming up with something new. And often that something new that's good, there's a lot of new things out there, but they're not all very good.
Right.
And so, you know, having the discipline and the long view, and I think for millennials this is particularly important, take the long view. Don't think that you can or even should sort of jump out of college and suddenly I'm an innovator.
Right.
Maybe it's 5 or 10 years in an industry that really sets you up for fantastic innovation when you're ready for it.
Yeah, and the beauty that I see in this Brooklyn Bridge project is the coming together of these two worlds. You know, there's the craftsmanship of cutting down the trees, getting actual wood, you know, whether it's planning or transportation, these are all well-established skill sets mm-hmm. that require great craftsmanship, even on the side of policy. But then you also have
Absolutely.
This innovative side of like, we need to do things differently. We need to do things in a way that may even threaten some of the well-established ways to get things done and solve problems. And we're going to cut against the grain about that because there's a higher value that's being trampled on that we need to honor here. What do you see coming together in terms of this Brooklyn Bridge project, and how do you see it moving forward?
That's such a great example, and you hit on a couple things. But just to expand on that, the craft of sustainable forestry is incredibly intense. I mean, low impact logging requires a very nuanced understanding of the forest. Understanding, you know, what type of tree you can and should cut, how you get roads in to minimize the impacts on the ecology, understanding the ecosystem as a whole. So it's really a wonderful area for young people in those communities to invest themselves in, because there's, I believe, a great future for that area, which is, a lot of it is a very pure craftsmanship, is learning sort of the sophisticated systems and rules of doing that well. But you also brought up the policy innovation. There's policy innovation and there's policy craftsmanship. And my goodness, policy requires a lot of discipline and craftsmanship to do it well. You don't just go into any kind of governmental sector and start rewriting policy. It's often years and years of work of developing trust to be able to have the opportunity to rewrite new and novel and innovative policy. You know, it's interesting, the hipsters in Williamsburg are sort of, in some ways, more interested in rural lifestyles in many cases than the people living in the communities. So it's a little bit inverted right now. So we really believe that interest in the rural lifestyle can be used to re-energize the actual work itself. So imagine people coming to visit the forest from New York City and spending some time there, taking some courses, maybe visiting for a week, maybe visiting for a year, and being part of that global dialogue. We've covered a lot of bases. I think the word design is such an interesting word that was probably just mentioned a few times, but running through all of this is just the idea of intentionality, that, you know, craftsmanship requires intentionality, so does innovation, doing something new, drawing people into a common vision. These are all design projects. So we think of design often as making a new object, but any leader is a designer, in my view. They're envisioning something new. They're testing it in context through dialogue. And so I would encourage all leaders to think of themselves as designers. What is it that they're actually, what do they want to create? What is this world that they envision? And how can they create that in cooperation with others, so that it is actually fulfilling and long-lasting and sustainable.
Thanks for listening to WorkWise. Check out the show notes for links to information on communities of practice and some really inspiring work by pilot projects, including co-design Manhattan office spaces, reimagined streetscapes, and of course, the Brooklyn Bridge Project, a plan for resurfacing the promenade with sustainably sourced tropical hardwood from a forest community in Guatemala. For more information on this and other episodes, visit creativitylabs.us. I'm Ken Kennard.